Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Charles Hood. He's a poet, naturalist, and author of 20 books. His adventures range from ski instructor to nature guide in Africa. His study of nature has taken him to all 50 U.S. states and 8 other countries, from New Guinea to the South Pole. And Charles Hood is the author of Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. Charles, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I'm so happy to be with you today. Thank you.
Well, I love the introduction to your book. You jump right into the fear factor that we all have of the dark. Would you be okay reading a few paragraphs from your opening?
Oh, you're very kind. Let me get ready to do that right now. So it starts out with the word welcome, and that's very intentional on my part. Welcome to the night, the least studied, least photographed, least appreciated segment of our planet's nonstop 24-hour go-go show. In this book, we'll look at how nocturnal nature works around the world, from the vertical migration of squid in the open ocean to the hunting strategies of a bat that targets millipedes and scorpions. We'll dance with fireflies and learn how the jungle experts photograph ocelots. Hint, try spritzing the trail camera with men's cologne. One intrepid animal we'll consider is the globe skimmer, which is also called the wandering glider. This is a dragonfly whose transoceanic migration route follows the monsoons from India to Africa and back again, with a stopover in the Maldives. No single individual dragonfly makes the full journey. Instead, successive generations use trade winds and rain-fed pools to propel the population on a global journey. The skimmer story reminds us that the world is richer, more diverse, more interesting, and stranger than many of us might guess. Most of us have a basic idea of daytime nature. Even if you've never been on a safari, you already know how to tell a zebra from a gazelle and a cheetah from a jackal. Nocturnal nature is much less commonly known, and some of us are even a bit hesitant about hiking after dark. After all, if we go out at night, won't we step on a snake or get dragged off by wolves? Quick answer is no to both.
I love that introduction. Charles, why do humans generally fear the night?
I think at this point we're trained to do it, and I don't want to be too Marxist or something, but there's a motivation for commercial industrial society to make us want to think, oh, we need more security lights, we need ring cameras, we better have extra deadbolts. So we're all purchasing this stuff to kind of keep night at bay. And unfortunately, that ties into, I think, sort of a demonization of dark things, dark places, that somehow it's more immoral to be out at night. I was thinking about this the other day. Werewolves are always shown as black, even though we all know real wolves can be gray or even blonde or even pure white in the Arctic, but somehow nature that's menacing is always shown as dark nature. Werewolves are always black werewolves.
Well, nature is pretty scary by itself, but nature at night can be terrifying. Why are you studying it?
I think it's part of our heritage to be able to access nature daytime or nighttime. And if we ignore the night half of the story, we're then losing half of our heritage. Since we know that nature is a 24-hour process, so therefore, by extension, there's plenty of things happening after dark. We're just not necessarily attuned to what's going on.
Well, that's a good point. So I don't know what got you all inspired to go out in the dark and start to look around. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in East L.A., along the Los Angeles River. So some of my first nature was just in vacant lots or at the Los Angeles Zoo. There was a hole in the fence you could sneak in the back way if you wanted to go to the zoo on the cheap, as I did when I was supposed to be in school. But then later on, as I began to photograph bats, then I realized I really need to get better at being out at night. I need to get a bat detector. I need to get a red flashlight so I don't lose my night vision and don't startle the animals so much. And then slowly I began to realize just how fun it really is to be out after dark.
As I was reading your book, I imagine you grew up in some rural region and were out exploring the nocturnal animals somewhere in a rural region of America, and there you are in L.A.
East L.A., so I grew up in the city lights, I have to confess. Very urban.
So what led you to write this book?
I do believe that people have a right to feel at home in nature, and if I can maybe increase our awareness of some of the wonders, that'll give people a little more encouragement, perhaps, to go out hiking. Even if it starts out, you're just in the so-called crepuscular realm, you know, dawn and dusk, so to speak. In that case, maybe even just extending our radius a little bit by another hour, staying out an hour later or starting an hour earlier. And I'm hoping the book will encourage people to realize it's to their advantage to learn all these things. that there's so much pleasure to be had and so much interesting information. Nature is accessible if we let it be.
Well, you've written a lot of other books. Tell me about some of those.
Oh, yeah, I'm a writing book kind of guy. That's what I do anyway. I started out as a poet, and so, you know, obligation is you publish your first book as your master's thesis and all that kind of stuff. But I did do a book about wild Sonoma, a little bit south of your listeners' radius. That was interesting, sort of nature of the wine country. I've done a book about reptiles and amphibians with some co-authors who are better at it than I am. I did a bird watching book called A Californian's Guide to the Birds Among Us. I did a mammal book. I'm a generalist. I'm an English professor who's just curious about the outside world.
Tell me about your education background.
Oh, no. Can we say this on air? I dropped out of college 9 times. Boy, was I not college ready. But whenever I was working, I'd have a job in a factory or, you know, some sort of less than desirable labor. And I realized, well, this is terrible. I better go back to school. I'd go back to school and the money would run out, or, you know, my work schedule would change. And so I'd have to go back to working full time. But ultimately, I ended up in a graduate program, sort of a hoity-toity MFA program. One of my teachers, Louise Glück, later went on to get the Nobel Prize in Literature. Although if I had known that was in her future, I would have had her sign every cocktail napkin in the room. So I ended up with a pretty traditional classical English, you know, education, and ended up getting a job in academia, kind of to my surprise, and it's perhaps.
Well, one of the things you're teaching us is that there's a lot to be learned outside of the classroom. My guest is Charles Hood, author of Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. So, Charles, your adventures have put you in some precarious predicaments, like the whiteout in the Himalayan mountains, and you've even contracted the bubonic plague. How are you still alive?
Yes, I often wonder that, and what was my good luck. It turns out, though, being alive today is easier to stay alive than it used to be in the past. So, yes, it is true I had plague. I got it in Oklahoma, crawling through a prairie dog colony, trying to see some birds. And when my buboes began to swell, luckily I have a classical education, so I know, hey, I know the signs of an onset of bubonic plague when I see it. And in the modern world, we have antibiotics, and bubonic plague is less virulent than it used to be. It's not the same, you know, it's not our grandfather's plague from 1353, so it's a little bit more survivable these days. And yeah, I've broken my leg hiking and broken my wrist mountain biking and, you know, bash myself up a bunch of places, but somehow I always get patched back together and keep on going.
Nothing,
luck, I guess.
Nothing deters you.
Well, it's just, I always equate it to driving. Like, if you drive long enough, you're going to get a flat tire. So if you're outside long enough, you're going to do something dumb and bang your head or bang your wrist or something. And just don't take it personally. Get patched up and carry on.
Well, what were you doing in the Himalayan mountains?
Oh, I have been lucky enough to go to Tibet. I've been to Mongolia. I've been to India 5 times or something. So I was keeping a mammal list to be, you know, a lot of your listeners know about bird watchers, and they keep a list of all the birds they've seen in their backyard, or they've seen that year, or they've seen in the world. And there's a smaller section of people, kind of fanatical, I guess, trying to see all the mammals, you know, if they can. And so that means you need to go places where you go where the animals are. Luckily, I've managed to ease off on that a little bit. I reached 1,000 on my mammal list, which may not, I don't know if that sounds like a lot to anybody in the listening world, but it's a lot in reality. Hard to see that many mammals. That puts me in the top kind of 10 people or something. And so now I'm trying to ease off of that addiction. It's not very cost-effective as addictions go. There's got to be cheaper ways to get your high.
That is a lot of animals. You mentioned that you wrote the book Wild Sonoma, and Jane Goodall wrote the foreword to that book. How'd you get Jane Goodall to write the foreword to your book?
Well, luckily, people know people, and so she and I share a mutual acquaintance. Her producer on her films, one of her American producers, and so I stay when I'm at person X's house. I stay in the same little cabin that Jane Goodall stays when she's at person X's house. But I think it was sincere. I think she did like how we were handling the content in that book. Again, kind of a joyful introduction to nature, meant to be inclusive rather than exclusive, and I think that ties into her worldview.
You also won Nonfiction Book of the Year for your essay titled, A Salad Only the Devil Would Eat. What was that about?
And there's a subtitle that we should tell our listeners, The Joy of Ugly Nature. Yeah, the salad only the devil would eat. And inside the publishing house, Heyday and Berkeley, hi Heyday guys, inside the press, everyone's taking credit for whose title was that. It's a phrase from one of the essays, but I think in my working draft, I just called it, you know, the essay book or something. It didn't have a great title. And so someone on the Heyday side came up with that, so the idea of a salad only the devil would eat. But where I live is in Southern California, outside of Los Angeles in the desert, and it has kind of a bad reputation locally. It's perceived as being where crystal meth is organized, and, you know, land doesn't have any value, so therefore the people don't have any value. And that just bugs me. I don't think that's fair when people exclude the inhabitants of a region just because your region isn't Malibu, for example. And so I ended up writing a sort of a love letter to vacant lots is really where that book came from.
Hmm. Oh, well, let's get back to your current book. You asked the question, why? Why are some animals out only at night? Why study nature at night? Well, why?
If you are a red flower, we'll say hypothetically you are a red flower, well, we're going to be pollinated by bees, perhaps, or by hummingbirds. But by golly, there are a whole lot of other red flowers all around us, all the other species of red flower and yellow flower, and so we have a lot of competition. If we switch over to blossoming at night, now we have to be kind of white, and, you know, red doesn't show up as well after dark, but, you know, we have a long tubular white flower like the top of a saguaro cactus has. Suddenly we have access to pollinators that the daytime flowers don't have. And so I'll give the example that, you know, of a saguaro cactus down in Arizona. All of those cacti are pollinated by bats, by nectar-eating bats. And the cool thing, if you're a cactus and you have a white flower and it only opens at night, is you don't burn up a lot of energy making nectar that's going to evaporate during the day. If you're a cactus, it's better to be actually active at night. So by having bats pollinate your flower, you're able to use the cooler part of the temperature, make nectar with less production, you know, less energy, and bats can fly hundreds of miles, so it's a great way to get your pollen distributed pretty widely.
So now you're talking about plants interacting with animals at night. So there's this whole ecosystem that happens after dark.
There is, and that's true to your west, off of the Pacific Ocean, where every day of the year, every night of the year, there's a vertical migration of trillions and trillions of organisms. So if we are a plant-based ocean organism, we have phytoplankton, we need sunlight, we have to stay at the surface. But if we want to graze on that phytoplankton, it might be better to come up at night when predation is a little bit less rigorous, a little less common. So at night we have all these things have been hiding out in the depths of the ocean, you know, 300 feet down, it's pretty dark, on down to a couple thousand feet. They vertically migrate, come up, feed at the surface. But then things that want to eat those things, so the squid want to eat the zooplankton that are eating the phytoplankton, they're up at the surface. And that means the dolphins are hunting at night. So the ocean is really this great vertical migration that is everybody coming up at nightfall and everybody going back down at sunrise. And for those of us who have been lucky enough to see dolphins from our boat, if you've been on a, you know, Monterey Bay boat trip or something like that, whale watching trip.
Yes.
Those dolphins are frolicking and they look so frisky and happy and just sort of living the good life. Well, of course, they're off duty. They've been feeding on squid all night. So they are fat and sassy. They are happy because they have time to socialize because they've been busy hunting all night.
So that's why they're swimming around, breaking the water and jumping around like they're happy.
Well, they are probably socializing, and they might be doing some dominance displays, but I'm willing to say that some of them are they do look happy whenever I see them when they're bow riding in front of the boat. They're just frolicking because they have enough energy. They're off duty. Their work day is over.
Well, this is interesting. This is interesting when you talk about migration, vertical migration in the ocean at night, but there are animals that do migrate in the air at night, right?
Sure, although the usual story of like bird migration that they fly at night, you know, using starlight and moonlight and polarized light and all the things that are all the, you know, the Earth's magnetic field and all the things that birds are doing. That's probably a little simplistic. I suspect it's more complicated than that, and that if we actually tracked individual birds more closely, I think they're feeding during the day, but not entirely resting. Some birds continue to migrate during the day, but it's also true that other things are migrating at night. Bats, for example, some bats migrate many thousands of miles. Some bats are up at 10,000 feet above the, you know, above sea level.
Let's hold it right there, because we need to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll jump into that. My guest is Charles Hood, author of Nature at Night: Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Mike Green. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Charles Hood, author of Nature at Night: Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. Before the break, we were talking about migration patterns, ocean migration patterns, and birds migrating at night. Charles?
So we were talking about birds, and I was saying, I bet some of them are doing more migrating during the daylight than the traditional narratives allow, although it is true, most birds are migrating at night. As we know from radar maps, we can see the mass of them moving. The bats have to migrate, not all of them. Some will hibernate during the northern winter, but others will just go back south, the same as tanagers or orioles. So some of these bats, such as the Mexican free-tailed bat, they actually can fly really well, very fast, very high. And so they're up at 10,000 feet on their migration, and they're going to go all the way from your listeners' area, from Northern California and Southern Oregon, all the way down to Mexico.
So if birds are navigating at night, how do we see them and how do we know this?
It's actually fun to look for migrating birds at night if there's a full moon, and most of your listeners have seen bird watchers use telescopes called spotting scopes, usually in the conversational language, although it's really just a small telescope. And if you aim a spotting scope at a full moon, maybe 10 o'clock at night during spring migration, you actually can see birds migrating against the face of the moon. They're not intentionally aiming at the moon. It's just that, you know, provides a light source, so they're backlit. And in fact, a full moon through a telescope is so bright, some people suggest wearing sunglasses if you're going to look for birds against the moon so you don't blow out your night vision. And so that's one easy way. People use just their iPhones to listen to passing bird calls. You can just passively have your phone recording and then download it in the morning, because the birds are actually saying, "Hey, over here. Look at me. Where are you guys going?" And so they're chattering back and forth. Not the territorial song, but sort of contact calls. And those are audible with any kind of recording device. Our modern smartphones are actually pretty good recording devices. And you can see them on radar. So we have lots of ways of checking the transit of things going on all around us.
Well, you also make recommendations on where to go to study nature at night. Can you talk about that?
I think any place that's close to home and that feels secure or safe to you. We don't want your listeners feeling anxious about it. But even the average nature trail, assuming it's legal for you to be there at night, which usually it is. If you even know a half mile or mile nature trail that you like during the day, it comes alive at night. You smell different things, hear different things. Your senses are alive in a way that they might not be during daylight. Because we're so visually dominant as primates, at night we have to turn our vision down a little bit and we get to use our other senses, so we get to smell nature in a way that we might not during the day.
You also offer safety advice and practical equipping for enjoying nature at night.
Sure. We want everyone to have a backup flashlight. And that's just the simple reality. You're going to drop your flashlight in the creek. If you have just one, it's going to break, or, you know, the battery's going to die. That's just, you know, Murphy's Law. So have a backup light and maybe even bring a friend just for the first few times. I do have friends that go out by themselves into the jungle and they come back alive every single time. But, you know, it's good to be a little bit sensible. On this radio program, we believe in common sense. So have a backup light and have a friend. Maybe think about where you're going to go, plan it out ahead of time, and then go out and have a great time.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And what would you take with you other than a
flashlight? Well, I bring a bat detector if it's summer and we're in the northern hemisphere. This is a little microphone that plugs into a smartphone, and it makes the bat's echolocation audible to my human range of hearing. And also then bats echolocate at different paces and different frequencies, the way birds have different songs. So if any of your listeners have used that Merlin application to know bird songs, you can actually do the same thing with bats and know what species of bat is above you. They're not singing like a bird, but they are are hunting and navigating, and they do so at kind of a predictable frequency. And so you can get a bat ID based on your smartphone, which has a little speaker plugged into the charging port. And I don't know. I just find that's really, I like knowing what's around me. The bat might be 30 feet up. You can't even see it very well, but there it is. Sure enough, there's a, you know, there's a canyon bat right above me, or a Myotis.
Well, how do you track animals at night, like a jumping mouse?
Yes, they're, you know, or the voles in your radius of your listeners. You have these redback voles up in the at tops of the trees. The trick there is to have a rich friend. You want to have a friend who's very generous with her or his wallet and her or his time, and make them buy what's called a thermal scope or a thermal binocular. This is not quite the same as the night vision binoculars, which the military uses. They kind of gather dim light, but there are devices that read heat signatures. They're looking for just the difference between a warm-bodied mammal and the ambient bushes all around it. And they're a little bit expensive. You know, we're running into some money on these. But oh my gosh, if you have a thermal imaging monocular or thermal scope, oh, it's astounding. You can just see the most, you know, you can see a puma or a bear. Sure, that's nice. But just in terms of, you can see bats, you can see wood rats, you can see the voles up in the tops of the pines. Suddenly the entire world is sort of like transparent. The night becomes transparent as these animals glowing white hot in your monocular reveal that they're up there on the bushes. We can't see them with the flashlight necessarily, but they're sure enough up there.
Well, tell me more about the vole.
Oh, you know, there's more rodents than any other group in the world in terms of mammals, second only to bats. Bats are almost as numerous, as many species of bats as there are species of rodents. And so in your radius, hey to our listeners, there are some animals that are only found in Northern California, and that includes a vole. So a vole is like a small mouse with kind of a half of a tail, and there are those voles that are particular to the tops of wet forests. Not the dry chaparral part, or not in the valleys by the farms, but in the good, dense coastal forest. They're up there. And their thing, that's what spotted owls are eating. You know, we know about the owls, and they are actually eating treetop voles. And if you get a rich friend who will come along with her or his thermal scope, you have a chance to actually see the voles in action. They're nocturnal, so you're only going to see them at night.
Well, we all have some idea of a few nocturnal creatures and birds, like bats and owls, like you mentioned. But you introduce us to moths and plants and night pollination. Tell us about that.
Well, that gets back to an idea we were talking about earlier, where daytime pollination is, of course, the norm, or we expect it to be kind of typical for lots of plants. There's other ways to be pollinated. The wind, like oak trees, could be pollinated by the wind. But if you're a nocturnal insect, you have a role to play in this too. So some plants really need moths as their pollinator, and they're actually easy to see once you begin to look for them. A roadside plant is called Datura, also called Jimson weed or loco weed. It likes disturbed areas, and it makes a big, showy, trumpet-shaped white flower, and those are almost all pollinated by hawk moths at night. I have some pictures in the book, and I just took them in my front yard. You know, it's actually not hard to see these kinds of moths once you just begin to look.
My guest is Charles Hood, author of Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. Charles, you've been to a lot of places and experienced a wide variety of environments. So what are some of the most unusual places and animals that you've experienced?
I was in West Africa once in the country called Gabon, part of a little team of people looking for an animal called a giant pangolin. And we know about pangolins, those are those old world sort of anteatery kinds of things that are prized for their scales, unfortunately prized by some human groups. But there's one that's never seen, the giant one. It's bigger than a Newfoundland dog. This is a big forest beast, only seen by the native trackers. And I went on an expedition to Gabon hoping to see one. We went out in the forest at night, but here I couldn't follow my own advice. We were camping, so we had no electricity, so we couldn't keep the batteries charged. So we're really trying to minimize our use of flashlights and just walk by starlight through the forest. And the guide starts shouting in French, "Run, run, run!" And I thought, oh no, we're doomed. There's a type of African elephant, the forest elephant, and they're very cantankerous, and they like to stomp on people. The savannah elephants out in Kenya, you know, they don't mind browsing along, letting safaris take their pictures. But the forest elephants, they're a little meaner. You know, run, run, run. Like, oh, that's it. We're going to get trampled. But actually, the run, run, run was because the guides had found a giant pangolin. And at that point, I want to say, other than researchers and other than native trackers, maybe 10 people had ever seen one alive. It was just like, oh my gosh, the world is so magnificent, so strange, so wonderful. I'm glad to be part of this planet.
So when you say your guide was telling you to run, it's run towards something and not away from something?
It wasn't clear. We were single file on a little path. It wasn't really a hiking trail. It was just sort of like a researcher's path through the forest. And so everyone just by instinct ran forward towards the shouting, which maybe is counterintuitive, but you know, you're going to go in the direction you're facing. When someone says run, you just start running. And it turns out, yeah, run, because I've located the prize here, the giant penguin. So it's an animal covered in like fingernail-like scales, and it's big. It's 100 pounds, 80 to 100 pounds, bigger than a Newfoundland dog.
Okay, so your guide found this big animal that's covered in scales. What does it look like?
They have kind of a pointy snout. So I bet if your listeners could imagine a sow pig, perhaps like the biggest sow pig you've ever seen at the county fair, only it's covered in, not like a porcupine, but in sort of covered in fingernails. That's the armor of it. And they can roll into a ball when they're being, you know, molested. The average penguin's about 3 feet long. This is just sort of the end of the Ice Age relic kind of idea. These are these monster species, the giant ones. And I don't know, I just wanted to see one. I just wanted to be part of the world that they're still around.
So how do you spell the animal's name?
This is a penguin, so P as in popcorn, P as in panda. So a penguin is P-A-N-G-O-L-I-N.
Okay, and you saw one.
And I saw the giant penguin thanks to my brilliant Gabonese nature trackers.
Is it kind of like a giant armadillo?
Yeah, that's a better. I should have said that. Thank you. I'm glad one of us is paying attention to this conversation. I should have said that. Yeah, just imagine a sort of an armadillo the size of a small pony.
Oh, wow. Okay. And how fast do they move?
Faster than you would guess, because we were trying to get photographs of it and go, you know, do the ooh-ah thing that you know, people do. And it decided, well, I don't know what you people are all about. I've never seen you before, but I'm leaving right now. And in fact, two of the strongest guides even grabbed its tail, just trying to hold it up for a second so we get one more picture. It just tossed them aside. It's like nothing, you know. It's a big, you know, it digs up termite mounds with these huge front claws. So it's a very powerful animal, kind of like a, you know, like a bulldozer or something. It's got tremendous force. And it just decided, I'm done with you guys. And it just left. And that was it. There was no following it. It just went off into the brush faster than we could run.
So it's not a carnivore.
No, it is. I guess you'd call it an insectivore or a, what's the Latin name for hormigas, for ants? It's an antivore, termitivore.
Gotcha. But it wasn't going to eat the humans.
No, it wouldn't. It couldn't bite us if it wanted to. I guess you would say it's a foraminivore. Our insect lovers on the can call in later and correct us. It eats termites and ants.
Gotcha. Well, I imagine the jungle has a ton of nocturnal life and death. But what are some of the animals that you've encountered at night in the jungle?
Well, I'm really a fan. Like, I went to Borneo. I'm a fan of things that don't do what they're supposed to do. So we all know about squirrels, and they kind of, you know, scamper around. But there are nocturnal squirrels, and they, quote-unquote, fly. That's with our air quotes. So they are gliders, and they glide from one tree to another. There is a flying squirrel in your area, the Humboldt flying squirrel, kind of a small little, pretty small, like chipmunk-sized squirrel. But in the old world, in India and in Africa, in Malaysia, Borneo, there are flying squirrels that are much, much larger. We're talking about the size of a poodle, and they go up, you know, scamper up the tree, and then to avoid predators, glide diagonally back down to the next tree. And there's lots of species. And then, I don't know, I think it's just kind of, again, cool, interesting, fun. It's a blessing to know that there are these animals flaunt through the night, and that if you put a little bit of effort out, you can go out and see them.
You know, one of the things that surprised me in your book is you introduced a desert flower that blooms only at night and only for one night. That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't recommend that as an evolutionary strategy. Boy, is that, yeah, the queen of the desert, queen, you know, the queen cactus. And they have them in captivity in Tucson, for example. Wow, they're sure hoping everybody is paying attention and that there's not a monsoon, you know, storm that night or something that's going to reduce their chances. But presumably what that cactus is probably doing is just putting literally all of its eggs in one basket. It takes a lot of energy to create a big showy flower and fill it with nectar, shoot up a stalk. And so it says, look, I can do this, but I'm only going to do it once a year. So you all better be paying attention now.
That is amazing. You've got some fascinating photographs throughout the book, like a canopy of glowworms and a moonbow. A moonbow. I've never seen that.
You haven't been allowed to look for it, I think is the thing, because moonbows could happen in our area too, where you are in Northern California. So it's just merely that there's a strong enough moon and enough of a mist to create a rainbow only as at night with the moon. The usual place to go see one would be Yosemite Valley. Go to the base of Yosemite Falls on a moonlit night, and you could usually get a moonbow that way. But they're all around. They could be just from a regular rainstorm.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I highly recommend this book. Thank you, Charles.
You've been very gracious. I appreciate spending time with you. Thank you.
My guest was Charles Hood, author of Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark.